Shunyata,
which is central to the Pranyaparamita texts, the perfection of wisdom texts, of which the Heart Sutra is the essence. Shunyata has been translated as emptiness or voidness. It means, basically, that everything is empty of any intrinsic nature. So if we take the Karen's orange that she mentioned earlier, before it goes all mouldy and horrible, there's nothing about that orange that is intrinsically an orange. Everything about it, whether it's the molecules or the atoms or anything like that, they haven't got something, you know, orange written on them. There's not something that makes it an orange. Those atoms, those molecules could just as well exist somewhere else, maybe in another citrus fruit or maybe in something completely different. So there's nothing intrinsically orange about it. This is in direct contradiction to some of the other religious beliefs, religious systems. To say a little bit more about this, I think the contrast with other beliefs, it helps to understand, it helped me to understand anyway. So in Christianity, in some forms of Christianity, particularly in Catholicism, you have this idea of transubstantiation. Don't know if you've ever come across that at all. But you know when, you know, they're singing communion, where the priest gives you the body, some wafer, you know, bread, essentially, or said to be bread, that's supposed to be the body of Christ, and wine that's supposed to be the blood of Christ. Now, according to the theory of transubstantiation, what happens when you take that bread and eat it is it changes from being bread to being literally the body of Christ. Now, the atoms don't change. The molecules don't change. None of the properties change. It still looks like bread. It tastes like bread. It smells like bread. But according to transubstantiation, its essence changes. So that in essence, it might look like bread, but in essence, it is the body of Christ. It's a bit like the idea of soul. The idea that we have our own unique soul. And it's a bit like saying that bread, its equivalent of a soul, changes so that it's not a bread soul anymore, it's the body of Christ soul. Does that kind of make any sort of sense? It's saying, you know, that essence changes. According to Buddhist theory, though, there is no essence. There is no unique essence in the same way that the Buddha said there is no soul. There is no unique, intrinsic thing that belongs to us that is unchanging and that stamps us as being what we are. In the same way, you know, so from a Buddhist point of view, this idea of transubstantiation is nonsense. Because there is no essence that can change to be the body of Christ. It is what it is. So in that point of view, Buddhism is entirely consistent with scientific theory. Now that's quite an important point, really. This is what is called in Buddhism insubstantiality. There is no substance, I suppose you could call it, you know, that thing that is unchanging and that makes a thing what it is. From a Buddhist point of view, no thing is what it is because everything is in contact and in relationship to everything else, and so it's constantly changing. Just like, you know, we're breathing in and breathing out, and the molecules we breathe in get taken into our body, into our bloodstreams, and become part of our body, and the carbon dioxide that we breathe out was in our body, but now goes out into the wider world. We're forever changing. The boundary between us and the world is forever changing. Maybe only in a small way in terms of human beings, but nevertheless it is always changing. Just like, not just spatially, but over a period of time, we also change. So there is no fixed thing that makes us what we are. Everything is a web of interconnected, ever-changing processes. Nothing is fixed, nothing is static, and hence there is no intrinsic nature of anything. We are all just in a temporary configuration. Just like we identify an orange, because it's in a temporary configuration that we recognise as an orange, and it's convenient to call an orange. But it is only a temporary configuration of molecules that will change. Now that can be, in some ways, a scary sort of scenario, because it means there's nothing fixed, there's kind of nothing to hold on to in a way. Everything's forever changing. From a positive point of view, it means that there are endless opportunities and possibilities. We can create or remove the conditions in order to make things how we want them to be, including ourselves. People have sometimes said to me, oh, you can't change what you are, you can't change your nature, or you can't change the way you are, can't change what you, the way you behave. Well, from a Buddhist point of view, that's complete nonsense. If that were true, then we might as well give up and go home, because Buddhism wouldn't work. And I think, you know, we can all see from our experience, if we think about it and analyse it, we do change the way we are. We do respond to stimuli and become different people. From a Buddhist point of view, we can have some conscious input into that process.
I think life would be much more terrifying if we didn't.
Well, yeah, I think they're right.
Change, it would be absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. So this idea of shunyata did emerge in later Buddhism, the Mahayana. Remember, I also said the branch out about 500 years after the original Buddhism. But it's a natural consequence on and builds upon the Buddha's original teaching of Pratichasamutpada, which has been translated as conditioned co-production and various other things. But basically, what the Buddha said was, everything depends upon conditions. Everything arises upon conditions. Nothing just exists in isolation. Everything is dependent upon its conditions. When those conditions change, then the thing changes or goes away. Which was quite an insight at the time, when people tended to think of, you know, and still do, you know, think of miraculous things just appearing, the sun comes up, there's no real reason for it, it just happens. But of course the Buddha understood that there are things that make everything happen. There are conditions. And we can work with those conditions once we understand that. So an example of how the way we can, the way we look at things, the way we look at things is not, of course, fixed. It's not at all objective. It's entirely subjective. And you might have had this situation where you've been depressed, or on the other hand, you felt on top of the world. And the world looks a very different place, depending upon your mind, your mindset. But it's our perceptions that are changing. The world is, you know, pretty much the world, isn't it, in all its flaws. It's our perception of it that changes. The things themselves are empty of any intrinsic nature. It's what we give to them, what we add to them, that that colours our perception of them. So those things actually exist and have properties. Our world is, to a large extent, determined by our perceptions and our responses to our perceptions. So it's very worthwhile reflecting on all of this, but in particular about what am I? What, you know, is that that I consider to be myself? And we'll come to that, back to that in a minute. In terms of the five skandhas that we looked at earlier, you can, and mental events, you can examine this yourself in terms of any intrinsic, seeing if you have any intrinsic nature. So, for example, if any sort of strong emotions, you could examine what's going on when you feel hungry, when you feel in love or lustful, or when you feel anxious or angry. You can just, it's worth just sort of stopping and being aware of what's going on in terms of these different processes. To what extent they emerge from sensations, and how you respond to those sensations, how you interpret those sensations, and the volition that you're bringing to this situation. I've become aware sometimes myself, even before becoming a Buddhist, I was aware sometimes that I would be acting, doing something that I knew in a way I'd kind of regret later. And there's a bit of me saying, no, it really would be best if you didn't do this. But I would just sort of push that to one side and just carry on doing it anyway, do my best to kind of ignore it. So consciously not being aware of what's going on. So it's worth trying to see what's your actual experience. It's particularly useful, I think, or it can be useful in diffusing things like difficult emotions, anxiety, not diffusing them necessarily, but helping to come to terms with things like anxiety or depression or grief and that sort of thing. Just being aware of them and you know, not trying to deny them, not trying to push them away, but just being there. And particularly with anxiety, I suppose, which can cycle into fearfulness, being fearful of the fear itself. You know, it can help to just sort of come to terms with that in a way and see, to an extent, that when you actually examine these things, there's nothing really you can actually put your finger on. So being imperfect, we are likely to experience various unskillful emotions. But examining them, we can see them to be empty and ultimately unhelpful. In lines 20 to 23 of the sutra, Avalokiteshvara gives us more detail. He goes on about the sense organs, for example. Notice that there are six sense organs. So in addition to our old friends, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, there's also the mind, whereas the mind can act as an input. If you think of memories or creativity, the way things can pop into your mind, apparently out of nowhere, I mean not actually out of nowhere, but it appears almost as if they come out of nowhere. And that can spark off a whole new train of discriminative thought, choice of volition, and so on. So in that sense, mind can act like a sense organ, like an input into itself. So Avalokiteshvara is encouraging us to have no real point of view. As long as we hold a point of view, then we're not really seeing reality as it is, because we're just looking at it from a particular angle, rather than seeing it as it is. So the idea, hopefully, is to get to no point of view, no bias, just seeing things as they are. That is to say, seeing it as it's ultimately empty of no intrinsic nature. Interesting to be aware of our own predilections, our own biases, the way people will support the policies of a particular party because they adhere traditionally to that particular party, perhaps, or a particular movement, whatever it might be, or a particular person, a particular football team, whatever it might be. You know, we tend to have habitual ways of responding, and we tend to often respond, you know, with some sort of bias, rather than just objectively seeing things as they are. So you could ask, why is this so important? Because certainly this idea of shunyata, emptiness, and trying to get some sort of understanding of it, is regarded as being quite important. Sangharakshita says, the only way you can get to reality is by destroying all your ideas about reality. So if we have these misconceptions about the way that things are, they will hinder us. So ignorance, that's to say an absence of spiritual wisdom, prajna, chains us to suffering through grasping for things. Just like in line 4, where it says, Avalokiteshvara sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. So these delusions that we have of permanence, satisfactoriness, and substantiality, those misunderstandings that cause us suffering, a realization of emptiness is an end to these things. So whether it might be something that you dearly desire, you've got your heart set on, maybe a really nice new car that everyone is going to make you feel just so great, isn't it? But when we analyse that, it's insubstantial. There is no essence. We've already talked about the way that, you know, you can change bits of a car and eventually the car will end up being a wreck anyway, sooner or later. It's impermanent. And really, it doesn't deal with the real longing that you have in you anyway. It's really just a mask for that. So ultimately, it's not going to be satisfactory either. So grasping is what causes us this suffering. This continual wanting things, realising that they don't actually, or perhaps not realising it, but sooner or later, you know, they're not going to give us the satisfaction we need, and so you're forever craving something else, something better. This is the irony, and this is ignorance in the spiritual terms. Even concepts such as ignorance and wisdom are themselves limited. Hence, realization of shunyata, emptiness, not just an intellectual understanding, leads us to liberation. So by removing ourselves from the sources of suffering, from grasping, then that removes us from suffering, as per the Four Noble Truths. You may have come across the terms worldly winds. In Buddhism, there's this idea of the eight worldly winds that blow us around and you know, affect us greatly. For example, the first one, the most obvious one, perhaps in some ways, well, maybe it isn't, but perhaps it is actually in these days of, in our celebrity culture, this idea of praise and blame. And you can see with celebrities how 1 minute they're built up to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, and the next minute they're all exposed and brought down again by the papers, and everyone's making fun of them, and oh, don't they look fat and everything, and all this sort of stuff. It must be, I find that very difficult myself, but that's this idea of praise and blame. And as long as you're subject to these things of praise and blame, then you're forever going to be blown about by them. Yes, it's okay being praised, and, you know, isn't that great, but sooner or later, the reverse is going to happen. So being able to rise above that slightly, in some sort of way, and look at it a bit more objectively, seeing it as it is, rising above these worldly winds, is likely to get us some more longer-lasting contentment and happiness. The other worldly winds, in addition to praise and blame, there's gain and loss, fame and shame, and happiness and despair. So the real aim of spiritual life is not happiness per se. Instead, it's really liberation. So that you're liberated from these worldly winds of being blown about by happiness and despair. So you can feel the happiness and despair. I mean, there's always going to be sadness if people leave or people die or something bad happens, some disaster. You know, there's always going to be sadness and there's always going to be happiness. But if you liberate yourself from those things having such control over you, then you can have a real sense of contentment. And you might get an inkling of that sometimes, well, more than an inkling, in fact, when meditating. You know, a sort of groundswell almost of contentment that can arise up, which doesn't appear to be based on any sort of external thing necessarily. So this kind of, this real aim of spiritual life, this idea of liberation, enables, in fact, a fuller engagement with life. You don't have the fear of engaging with life in the same way. And a deeper sense of happiness and contentment, which perhaps we don't really have a word for as such.